case, which is the Rigdon case, and that would be Mr. Powers and Ms. Johnson. And are the parties ready to proceed?
We're ready, Your Honor.
Very good, thank you. Sir, you may come forward. And would you like to reserve some rebuttal time?
Yes, Your Honor, I would. I'd like to reserve about 4 minutes, or 5 minutes, I guess.
Certainly.
For time on rebuttal.
You may proceed, sir.
May it please the Court, I'm McMillan Powers, and I'm here today representing Daniel Rigdon. And before we get started, I do want to address an issue. This is for Judge Frank. There is a duplicate sentencing order in this case. It is a misprint. It is the exact same order duplicated twice, so there's only one order we're appealing from. And I know that came up in a case before out of our office, but I'm not sure how that happened. I've never seen that printing error, but it got put in there twice. It's not in the index, so I missed it in looking through the index. But nevertheless, Mr. Rigdon was tried on a bunch of seven actual counts on different sexual offenses, was found guilty of contributing to the delinquency of his daughter and his daughter's friend, and also indecent exposure, indecent liberties as to the friend. The issue here is whether or not after the verdicts were returned and trial counsel at that point makes a motion to set those aside because the misdemeanors on which he was found guilty were brought about 4 years, a little over 4 years, nearly 4.5 years after the events that occurred. The indictment alleged that the events occurred in 2010. It was later amended to 2012. The indictment came down December of 2016. So we're well past the one-year statute. Now, the statute does contain some additions that lengthened the statute, but they're not at all applicable. They were 2016 amendments to the code as a result of some cases that were decided, as well as some other things, and it includes some really unusual events, but that's not at all the issue. The issue is whether or not under the cases that have been decided, particularly Rose and Brooks versus Payton and Locklear, whether or not it is timely to make such a motion and up until final judgment. That's the language of Rose, and it's affirmed in Brooks and also in Locklear. And that's what the case law says, that if you make your motion before final judgment, which would be within the 21 days.
Those cases deal with a statute of limitations violation?
Yes, Rose does. Specifically,
and how does it address Rule 3A9?
It does not at all address Rule 3A9. And when there's a statute, and when there's a rule, and when there's case law, the rule is like not going to beat the statute.
Statute's
going to beat the rule.
But case law
is flexible. Case law is flexible. The rule is set there, and the trial counsel did not do a 3A9 motion prior to trial. They did make the motion immediately after the verdict, and that's the issue that we're here on that aspect. It's a very clean issue. Does the language of Rose and Brooks versus Payton and Locklear and that line of cases, did they allow the trial counsel to do it the way trial counsel did it or not? It's very simple. Now, the cases that the Attorney General cites particularly two federal cases, I don't think are applicable. First of all, they're from the Fourth Circuit, so they're not controlling authority here. They're not that. There may be some guidance, but they're not the guidance that this court would look to because the federal rule does not have the Rule 1-1 21-day period in which to make a correction. And that doesn't even really come into play here because the request was made immediately. It didn't even wait one day after the trial, and it was well within any 21-day period that would have ever happened because there was no order entered. So at that point, it's simply a matter of does the language that the court has espoused actually allow trial counsel to do this procedure the way that the trial counsel did it, or does the Rule 3A9 trump that, and you now have lost what I think is a considerable benefit, because the way the language of the cases is, you have this right to make this challenge anytime, and it, even the federal cases say you can make it at trial, which includes up until the end of the trial, which would be the entry of the order. So even the federal cases that are cited talk about being able to exercise the right to call the statute of limitations into question up until the end of the trial and the entry of the order.
After the jury's been released?
Well, as soon as the jury was, you still got Rule 1, 21 days. If the order had been entered and the ink was still wet and the jury walks out, you'd still have the 21 days in which to come with your motion, but it didn't happen that way. The court just adjourns court. Counsel then stands up and says, I want to have a motion set aside, and this is the reason, because the statute one brought within the 1 year for the misdemeanors. And it's just very simple. In a sense, it's very simple. Does that right now just get extinguished because of Rule 3A9? Does it end, or does it still...
I want to stop you for just a second, because I didn't think I'd ever remember it, but I was just looking at Rose versus Commonwealth. Rose versus Commonwealth is a speedy trial case. Rose is whether the person was brought to trial within four terms of court from the indictment. And the court says he was, but the court also indicated in there something to the effect that the issue was not raised until after trial. So I'm not sure Rose, you know, is a case you want to stand on, because it doesn't deal with statute of limitations.
To the extent that
speed, and it was affirmed that he was executed.
He did, unfortunately. That was a bad result for Mr. Rose.
Particularly for him,
in that specific case, it was a very bad result. But Rose is cited in Brooks for that proposition that you can invoke the statute of limitations up until the end of trial. And it cites Rose for the proposition that you have the right to invoke a statute up until the time that the final order is entered. Now, that was a statute that is a speedy trial, and then you get it
but
to the...
But Brooks is a speedy trial also.
It's a habeas situation on speedy trial.
Statute dealing with speedy trial said the court, for good cause, can allow you to raise it at a later time.
It is, and there's a difference.
And Rule 3A9 doesn't have that exception.
It doesn't have that exception, and there's a separate provision in the code for the pretrial motions on speedy trial and suppression and constitutional issues, and that's separate from 3A9, and it's separate from 18.2-8.
So you've got to find some way around 3A9. 3A9 controls.
Your Honor, the only way I have around 3A9 is what I've told you, and that I don't have any reason to understand, and I cannot tell you why trial counsel did not do 3A9. I can't tell you that. I don't know. All I know is what they did, what I have here, and why I think that it's still a motion well taken.
You'd have thought the Commonwealth attorney drawing indictment would have perhaps realized that's a mighty broad spread for a misdemeanor.
Someone should have noticed that prior to the commencement of trial. Prior to putting a jury in the box, somebody should have known and should have called a halt and said, time out, we need to go back and amend, we need to have an adjournment, we need to do something. It did not happen. The court didn't do it. Trial counsel didn't do it. Commonwealth attorney didn't do it.
It can be waived.
It can be waived.
So if that, maybe somebody decided there was some tactical advantage to waiving that, hoping they'd get the conviction on the misdemeanor and avoid the felonies.
Your Honor, I don't know what happened there, and that's I suppose we will never know until there's a habeas in which someone wants to psychoanalyze what trial counsel was doing.
Counsel, the speedy trial issue, isn't that a defect in the institution of the prosecution? Unlike speedy trial that doesn't develop till after the prosecution.
After it starts.
That's
yes.
Correct. But speedy trial is something that is, to me, it's a defect in the initiation of the prosecution. Am I right or wrong?
I'm not sure that I exactly understand your distinction. It's not a defect in the indictment, but a speedy trial isn't.
But it's a defect in the institution of the prosecution, isn't it?
Under the rule.
Under 3A:9b-c.
That would be a speedy trial. Potentially could be. But there's a separate provision for speedy trial.
No, I'm just talking about this case, statute of limitations. It exists.
It exists for that. I agree with that. It exists for that purpose.
It exists or not before the institution.
Yes.
Of the prosecution.
I agree with that.
So why doesn't 3A:9 apply here?
I think that 3A:9 and the idea that you have the right to call forth an objection to a statute of limitations, that right exists up until the end of trial. And that's
based on
the fact that you have the right to call into question other things up until the end of the prosecution and the entry of the final order. That's it.
Well, when I read Brooks doesn't say that say anything about having the right before trial. It simply says if you wait after trial, you clearly can't raise it.
Right.
But it doesn't stand for the proposition that you can raise it after trial commenced. The only comment it says, the protection of the accused under speedy trial is not self-operative. Failure to invoke the provisions of the statute until after final judgment is a waiver. Cite Rose.
Right.
Well, that's a true statement of the law, but it doesn't mean that failure to raise it until halfway through trial isn't a waiver.
That's the decision that's before this court. I'm laying out what I think is the best way to come to the conclusion that Mr. Rigdon wants to come to. I see that I'm getting ready to get into my rebuttal time. I do want to address the 295.2, but I will just wait on that and see what the Commonwealth and the Attorney General want to say about that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Powell. Ms. Johnson.
Good morning. May it please the Court. I'm Victoria Johnson on behalf of the Commonwealth. The Court should affirm Mr. Rigdon's convictions because the issues on appeal are waived and otherwise in the case of a sentencing issue without merit. To start briefly with the statute of limitations, it's the Commonwealth's position that that needs to be raised pretrial. Now, under the Rule 3A:9, the court could waive that for good cause found if the court wanted to do so, but the court doesn't abuse its discretion in not waiving that requirement. That's the Upchurch case and also the Cook case that I cited on brief, which dealt with the pretrial motions for suppression. Here, this is a defect that pre-exists the time of indictment. It's a bar to prosecution, and that should be raised before trial under the rule. That's the Commonwealth's position. If the court has questions, I'm happy to answer them. I think it's fairly straightforward.
I do, please.
Yes, Your Honor.
Did the trial court talk about that issue was waived because of Rule 4A:9?
No, Your Honor, the court did not. The court did not elaborate on its holding.
Address the merits?
I don't believe the court did address the merits. I think the court just said your motion's denied. It's my recollection from the transcript.
So your position is that the trial court didn't waive the requirements of 4A:9?
No, Your Honor, the court did not waive it. The court did not address the merits.
Was there any request to the trial court to consider the motion even though it wasn't timely?
No, Your Honor. There was no good cause argument made. And for the record, the prosecutor stated that in the argument that she believed that this charge, the contributing charge, fell under the exceptions in the statute of limitations. There are several.
Rule 1.
Yes. I recall someone telling me that very early in my career, Your Honor. And moving along to the sentencing issue, that again, the constitutional challenge is waived. That argument was not made in the court. The only argument that was made in the trial court by the defense attorney at the time was that the statute, the jury sentenced him and the statute doesn't allow you to do this. And the judge rejoined, yes, the statute exactly tells me to do this and that's why I'm doing it.
Is this case controlled by Alston versus Commonwealth?
Yes, Your Honor, if the court were to reach the merits, it is controlled by Alston. It is also, to the extent counsel, you know, appellant raises a due process claim, that's controlled by Boyd, which is this court's.
There's no Sixth Amendment right to even be sentenced by a jury. That's a state, a unique state statute.
Yes, Your Honor, and under Boyd, this court held that there was no due process right to be sentenced by a jury or solely by a jury in either the federal or state constitution, the Commonwealth Constitution. And so even if the court were to reach the merits on the sentencing issue, I submit that it's foreclosed by precedent. If the court has further questions, I'm happy to answer them. Thank you, Your Honor. Then I would rest on my brief and ask you for them. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very briefly. On the 295.2 issue, I understand I've been here previously in this regard, and I know pretty much where the court is on this. I do believe, however, and I sincerely believe this, that the Constitution requires, once you get a jury in the box and the jury is going to sentence, that that jury is the one that sentences.
Is
and
there a constitutional right to have a jury sentence you?
No, there's no constitutional right to that. I agree.
Is there any fact finding that the jury does that Apprendi would apply to? Yeah, in a sentencing context.
Okay. I think what your honor is talking about is
something that the jury has to find beyond a reasonable doubt in sentencing that would implicate Apprendi and Ring.
I think this is what they have to find once they in our bifurcated trials now. Once they find guilt, then we have another little session in which we put on evidence. Commonwealth, everybody puts on evidence going as to guilt. Going as to the punishment. Guilt's established, now we go as to punishment. At that point, the jury has to make some kind of a finding in order to come out with what it is that they're going to sentence.
The finding they make is, we think you ought to serve 10 years in the penitentiary, but they don't have to make any factual findings to support that.
No, but the facts on which they...
That's what Apprendi is based on it.
Yes, and but the fact that they have to have before them is that he was convicted by them. Now, once you take it out of that and you give it to the judge at the sentencing hearing, he now has a fact that they were not told specifically they had to consider. If you find him guilty, you can give him 10 years and 3. And they're not told that. Now, no instructions asked for.
The judge does not give him any additional time. He simply puts him on probation for a period of time after his release.
He imposes.
There's almost a no harm, no foul.
Except for the fact that this is where the harm comes in, and this is what all, as I read the cases, and particularly as it applies in Virginia, what happens is I get the 3 years extra, and it's all suspended for good behavior for 3 more years. The point is, I served my 10 years, now I've got 3 years to go, and something else happens. And what will happen is the parole board will bring me in, and they will now make a determination as to how much time I spend in prison, and not the fact finder. I mean, they're going to be the ones do it. It's not the jury anymore, and it's not the tribal judge anymore. And that seems to be the additional punishment that implicates the Fifth and Sixth Amendments, it seems to me.
Your argument that Apprendi is applicable to jury sentencing in this context would to me suggest that it would be appropriate for a defense attorney to make a motion to strike after sentencing because the Commonwealth hadn't proven something that was necessary to support the verdict. Could it do that? Could an attorney do that?
If Your Honor will write that in an opinion, we'll start doing it.
I
don't know. I mean, I certainly trial counsel.
General Assembly.
Yeah, trial counsel could do that. I don't know that the motion would be well taken based on the state of the law, but if that is written into an opinion somewhere that that's some dicta, then I'm sure that that will start happening, and that motion will then be made that based on Apprendi, they didn't have these facts, and so now we're moving to strike or to set aside on that basis. My final comment, I know I'm out of time, my final comment is that despite the nature of these criminal cases, I would prefer to do this than adoptions.
All right.
How about